This is the Why We Travel podcast, the podcast dedicated to those who want to explore the world on their terms. Each week, you'll hear from amazing travelers and experts sharing their best travel stories from the road. Listen to their unique travel experiences and get insider tips about their favorite destinations. Whether you're an experienced world nomad or just getting started, this podcast will inspire you, improve your travel skills, change the way you travel, and motivate you to get out and see the world. Discover the art of independent travel and meet fellow travelers in our online community. Now, let's get into it with your host and world traveler, Claus Lauder. Welcome to the show.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Why We Travel podcast. Today's episode will take us on water. So we're talking about adventures and experience traveling on a boat. Therefore, I have a very special guest with me, Stephen Ladd. Stephen Ladd is an American city planner, voyager, and memoirist. He is the author of The 3 Years in a 12-Foot Boat, in which he rode and sailed to South America and back in a tiny boat on his own design. In 2009, he teamed up with his now wife, Virginia, to sail to Argentina and back, largely via 8 major South American rivers in a 21-footer. So he has a vast experience on being in boats, traveling the world on water, and we want to dive into this topic a little bit more today. So hello, Stephen, how are you today?
I'm doing fine, Claus. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Stephen, tell me a little bit, what is your first memory in becoming a traveler?
Well, my first memory actually was at the age of 2 when I was traveling in the Eastern United States with my parents. My first memory was of the Lincoln Memorial. It's where Abraham Lincoln is sitting on kind of like a big throne inside of a dark chamber. It was very dramatic to me. So I remember that. I guess you call that traveling. We were on vacation touring the East Coast.
Okay. And when did the travel bug really hit you?
I don't remember not having it. When you're a little kid, you only travel when your parents travel, I guess. But as soon as it was conceivable, I traveled on my own.
Okay, cool. Now, you have done a couple of years traveling around the world. So you basically went up and down North America in boats. You actually built your own boat. Tell me a little bit about how did you get to that idea?
So as soon as I graduated from high school, I traveled for a year by myself in Europe, Asia, and Africa. That was hitchhiking, taking buses, and to a fair amount, it was motorcycling. It began with motorcycling and ended with motorcycling. In between, it was other modes of transport. And that was a traumatic experience, which I have written about, but it involved a lot of really crazy stuff, like getting caught up as a refugee in a war between India and Pakistan and being in prison in a Moroccan jail for a month. I came back home and started a conventional career, going to college and so forth. But the travel bug was always there. And I kept it at bay by ongoing every weekend adventures, a lot of cross-country ski, backpacking, backcountry skiing trips in the mountains and other forms of localized travel, localized adventures. But then that in my mid-30s is when I started building the boat and planning the voyage that culminated in my 3 years in a 12-foot boat story. That was a very nice cycle, the beginning of just extreme wanderlust, finally being satisfied, so very euphoric. And it was like a novel, supposed to have a beginning and a middle and an end. It had a crux phase of it. Very, very difficult and dangerous at times. But then it came to a conclusion. I got all the way back home. Nobody thought I could. And a boat that is so light that it's so small, it's intended to pull it up onto the beach at night. It's like a canoe or a kayak. You can pull up on the beach at night to get out of the water. And that's the boat that I traveled to South America, through South America, and then back through the Caribbean. So then that was all satisfied. I've had 2 major trips now in my life. That one that I was 18, the one when I was 36, and then I met who's now my wife, and it was really her instigation to start the latest voyage, the one that the newer book is about. She knew I would have it in me, and so she sort of left it as an ultimatum that she wanted one now, and did I want to come? And so it was her idea, but once I got started with her, it was just great. And those two that are books are written about them, they're the same in that they're about very small boats, boats just big enough for the task at hand. When I was by myself, I could be in a 12-foot boat. With my wife, I had to be in a 21-foot boat to do the same things with the same level of accommodation, which is very low. Just virtually no electronics or refrigeration or mechanical assistance. That isn't quite true. The second book has a motor part of the time. But in the first story. I was alone and battling with my loneliness and fear and so forth. And in the later voyage, I was with my wife, therefore not as lonely and not so fearful because you have somebody else to buck you up. And you have the courage of two instead of the fear of one.
Okay. Now, just to give an expression for people who do not know what 12 feet is, that's just 3.65 meters. So that's what an average car has on length. So it's very little. Now, obviously, with that, you have a very minimalistic lifestyle. How did that impact your travel?
It was really integral to it. I always am a minimalist at home, not an extreme minimalist, but as a matter of choice. And I just enjoy the challenge of small things, having a less powerful motorcycle, just a little one, riding a bicycle a lot. So the idea of being in a small boat was really not a negative. It's kind of fun. With a small boat, you just get a pat. If nothing else works, you just get a paddle. You don't have to go down to the engine room and figure out why the compressor is not working today or something like that. You just got a paddle. If you want to look ahead, you just turn on your flashlight. You don't worry about anything complicated. So anyway, you can just get around. You're close to the water. You're right in the action. Go right up the little creeks. Go into little bays. You're very intimate with where water and land come together. It's not blue water sailing. The blue water sailors, they want to be out on the ocean. You know, they want to go across the Pacific Ocean. In 3 months, I'll be in Tahiti or something like that. Well, this is totally different. It's like wide crossings are necessities that can't be avoided and are unpleasant, but you make it. But what you really like is when you get where you're going to go and you've got a little stream mouth, a creek mouth, or a little lagoon or a mangrove opening into the mangrove swamp, that's when it's nice, assuming you can combat the insects, of course.
We're talking about rivers here. Give me a bit of an idea what the trip route was. So just for our listeners that they get an idea, you obviously did not necessarily go, as you said, on blue waters along the coastline. You went inland, you went on rivers. What was the route?
I'll refer now to the newer book, The 5-Year Voyage. That is a rendering of our boat. This kind of situation did happen, and that is that we were, in this picture, we're in a small stream. We're for some reason having to go up the stream. I am pushing it and she is on the bow with a pole, poling. And so it gives you an idea of the scale. And these are shallow draft boats. The boat is only drawing about 6 inches down into the water. So you can go until the water is no longer at least 6 inches deep. On that trip, it has some overlap with my earlier travel. We found ourselves upon getting down into South America on the coast of Venezuela. You have to understand that this involves portaging. A portage is where you move a boat across land to get to some place where you can put it in the water again. And these portages are not human powered. They're not putting the boat on our heads. We're having to figure out different ways to transport the boat, sometimes free, negotiate a payment. And that boat's 21 feet long. It weighs about 700 pounds plus our gear. It's probably another 300 pounds. So it's not trivial, but it's also doable. That's not that hard really to move something of that size. It might be a pickup truck. It might be a car that has a boat trailer, use their boat trailer. And in a couple of cases, it was just actually on top of somebody's cab of a vehicle. You find people who are willing to try something a little bit different to make a little money. Although half the time we didn't have to pay anything. At any rate, so you get into South America and there are these major river systems in South America. And I suppose all continents have major rivers, but South America has major big rivers, you know, it has the biggest rivers in the world. And so there's ways to connect your travels here. The first major connection was one that is a geographical oddity. It allowed us to go right up one river and then go down and into a whole different drainage basin. That's due to the fact that the Orinoco and the Amazon, or at least tributaries thereof, you have to understand that any one river system is many, many different branches. But these two river basins in one of their two extremities, they meet and actually are the same thing. And so we were able to come up this one and then down this one. So by going up the Orinoco, we come into the Amazon on a backdoor route of the Amazon where the countries of Venezuela, Colombia, and Brazil intersect. So now we're going down, it's the Rio Negro, and get into the main stem of the Amazon. We continue down the Amazon and we're going a southerly direction throughout. And then we come to the mouth of the Madeira. Well, Madeira is a very large tributary as well. And we went up it. So we're still going south upstream. We went to Bolivia that way because Bolivia thought of as an Andean country. Well, most of it is, at least half of it is actually in the Amazon. And so we come into Bolivia going up this stream. These individual legs take months each. We get to the top of that stream to where, like I said, it's only like a foot deep, and that's as far as you can go. And we ranged a portage to the next major river system. Well, in this case, you have to go across a little divide. I think it was a 200-mile truck trip, and it got to a different drainage basin. This is the Paraguay River, and we promptly have a major challenge ahead of us, which is that The first several hundred miles was through the world's biggest swamp, the Mato Grosso Pantanal. It's only swamp for hundreds of miles, and you're going through the middle of it, and there's no maps of it. We sort of mapped it ourselves, as we always did. We used Google satellite imagery, like on Google Earth, and we used certain tools to create maps that could then be visible on our handheld GPS. And so we were able to figure out when there's forks and meanders and curly cues, you know, which one to take. And when the stream you're on flows into some big lake, figure out where on the other side of this lake to continue on the river. We were able to figure that out. And largely thanks to my wife, she's good at that sort of thing. Anyway, so that got us to the Paraguay. The Paraguay feeds into the Paraná, which flows into the Rio de la Plata, which is where Buenos Aires, Argentina is. And that's like half the way. We're gone as far as we can go then. The voyage is halfway over because there's no further rivers going south. And then began the reverse. But that's a different set of rivers. So I'll take a pause here in case you have any questions.
Oh, that's absolutely, for me, a true adventure travel, what you did there. Obviously, you getting there in areas where there is no travelers, no tourists, no infrastructure. So how's the experience? And you did it basically twice. And first question you probably get the most is, wasn't that dangerous? So from your perspective, how did it feel? Did you get in dangerous situations?
Mm-hmm. We're always trying to survive, but it was dangerous. And sometimes it's remarked to me that I've taken too many chances in my life. Maybe I have, but I'm still here. So it's worked out. There are very many scary moments. We had some really frightening moments, but we always figured out, and maybe we were lucky. We survived.
Okay. How were the encounters with the locals? They were probably surprised coming, the two people coming on a boat all the way down.
This sort of a traveler, this sort of a visitor is never something they have experienced. We never ran into people who said, oh yeah, another boater coming down the river, huh? No, it was always like, what? Or in one case, I remember we were in a certain part of South America, and we kept hearing, oh, about 2 years ago, this other guy came down the river. He was in a kayak. He came down the river too. So there had been one other person. We heard about that. There's people always are interested in indigenous people. They're the main population. And to the extent there is a population, a lot of these areas are extremely unpopulated. There were times when we went for 1 week traveling on the river without seeing another human being. That's how unpopulated it is. And wherever there is population, tends to be on the water. If you go into the jungle and proceed further in, you have less chance of seeing people in there. But there's a lot of beautiful nature still left there, especially in the Rio Negro area, which was our favorite. That's the major tributary of the Amazon, which has what they call it black water. It's a water that's clear, but with tannic acid. It's translucent, but it has a tannic coloring, and that tannic acid prevents the growth of mosquitoes. So it's a very healthy climate.
Okay. No mosquitoes is obviously very helpful. Both of these travels were year-long travel. So 3 years, 5 years. How do you financially plan for such an adventure?
Just savings. It's not difficult to arrange for your finances. In the 1990 to 93 voyage, it was more difficult because that was the days of traveler's checks. In remote places, they don't necessarily take traveler's checks. And so you're scrambling a little bit there sometimes. So anyway, the source of the money, savings, that's never been an issue for us because we're savers anyway. We're minimalists, which also kind of means we're savers. We've had decent jobs, but we don't blow it all on cars and stuff. Therefore, we have the money. The question is how you get that money accessible to you when you're in Timbuktu, figuratively speaking. There's the differences between the early 90s and the latter voyage, which was in the later 2000s, which is that there are still difficulties in the latter voyage too. Those took place only in certain countries. Certain countries are, I'd have to say, repressive as to financial arrangements. If you're willing to do what they want you to do, fine, but it's going to cost you a lot more than the black market will allow you to do. There's always a question whether to participate in the black market and to weave your way through these little nets they put there to catch you, either prohibit you from doing what you want to do or hassle you to the point where you just give up or to make you pay these artificially high bank rates so as to get more money from exterior sources. There were challenges that way too, but we did pretty well there. Once you figure those things out, you can stretch your dollars pretty well.
Okay. Now the other way around, after traveling for a long time, coming home, settling in brackets in normal life, was that a challenge as well?
No, not really. When you travel unto saturation, you're ready to be back home. It's a good feeling. We have, as you can see in the background of my image, some of the pictures of the flags we accumulated. These flags are actually in the order of the countries. We got a flag for most of the countries, not all of them. So we put our flags. These are the flags. You're not really required to fly them on your boat, but it's kind of a tradition that you do. It's a courtesy. These are all the courtesy flags of all the countries. And we put them up on the wall and it looks nice. And we live with our wonderful memories.
Yeah. If somebody nowadays would want to do a trip like this or a similar trip, what would be your recommendation how to get started with that?
There's a lot of technical stuff about what kind of boat to have and how to handle a small boat. And there's a lot of technical stuff about your gear choices and your bureaucratic choices. But to me, the central point is not the mode of transport, but that you do travel in a saturated way, in a way into the deep middle of the middle, and really getting away from it all, especially for young people. I think that the younger you are, the better it is for you to travel. It's like the idea of the Aborigines who go on a walkabout, or Native Americans would call it a spirit quest. It pertains to all of us. We should all do that. We should take it seriously. I mean, it's fun. It can be fun, but it should be taken seriously. It's something that is really a good thing to do. I mean, obviously, it's only a choice for people with some affluence, I guess, that have that amount of savings and take that time in on their lives. But to me, that should be a major priority for anybody, if they can swing it, to do something like that.
So where can people find out more about you? I understand you have written some books about your travels.
Yeah, my books are anywhere fine books are sold. You can get them through your local bookstore or through Amazon.
Okay. And where can people find more about you? Do you have a website or Instagram?
If you just take the correct spelling of my name, which is Stephen, but then you put a dash before my last name, Ladd, then that plus the www at the beginning and the .com at the end, that's my website. I have an author website. Help yourself, any of your listeners, to other writings that you will find there. I write mostly on traveling subjects and other adventures besides what's in my book, but I have writings on other topics as well. Boating, for example.
Okay. I will put the link in the show notes and you're just one click away. Stephen, thanks so much. I think you had an awesome trip there. I wish more people would do that and get really into the hinterlands of countries and explore countries from that end. And instead of only going to the most touristy places in a country, it gives you a complete different experience. Thanks so much for your time.
Okay. Thank you, Klaus. Have a good one.
You too. Hey, Klaus here. Before you leave, I have a question. Are you a traveler? Do you have a favorite travel destination or favorite travel experiences that you would like to share with the world? Then become a guest on the Why We Travel podcast. Simply message me and I will get you all the details for becoming an interview guest. And then we take it from there. That's it for now. I see you in the next episode and have a great day.